We'll hear arguments next in 1359, Bankers Trust against Malice and Kupferman. You may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, Section 10B and Rule 10B-5 under the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 does not prescribe all fraudulent schemes that have anything to do with securities. It only prescribes and renders unlawful those fraudulent schemes that are, quote, in connection with the purchase or sale of any securities. End of quote. This case presents two questions. One, whether a pledge of securities as collateral for a commercial loan was a purchase or sale herein within the meaning of the 1934 Act, which defines purchase, quote, to include any contract to buy, purchase, or otherwise acquire, end of quote, to permit a pledgee to bring an action under Section 10B and Rule 10B-5. The second question is whether the in connection with requirements of the Act is satisfied when a bank which releases collateral to its debtor upon the repayment of the indebtedness as it was required to do under law and the alleged sale is the pledge of securities by a third party to a plaintiff who is totally unknown to the bank. The facts in this case are fairly simple. Bankers Trust.
Did you say they're simple?
Yes, Your Honor, they are fairly simple.
I read the briefs in this case about a week ago on an airplane, and I thought I was going crazy. I thought the...
Well, maybe I could help clarify that
for
you, Justice
Gillerson.
Maybe I could help clarify.
Just proceeding.
Them for you, and feel free to interrupt and ask any questions, Justice Gillerson.
We won't hesitate.
Thank you, sir. Bankers Trust is a bank. It received approximately 40,000 shares of Equity National stock as collateral for a loan in August of 1970. At that time, the lending officers received an opinion letter of counsel that the stock would be negotiable within 6 months. When a bank receives a pledge of stock, it does not look to the collateral for repayment. It primarily asks how the indebtedness is going to be repaid and looks at the creditworthiness of the borrower plus other elements relating to repayment. A banker does not make a loan with the expectation that he's going to be required to foreclose on collateral to collect its indebtedness, regardless of whether the collateral is stock, real estate, cattle, or accounts receivable financing. A banker does not want to be involved in an expensive foreclosure proceeding. He doesn't want to have to use lawyers. He merely wants a return of the monies he loaned. The bank, in this case, played no role whatsoever in arranging with Malice and Kupferman, the respondents herein, to borrow money from Franklin National Bank, which they then loaned to Arnold and Fowler, and received a pledge back from of collateral from Arnold and Fowler's.
Let me just isolate, if I may, the very first part of the transaction, correct, which you described, where the Bankers Trust received the pledge from the Georgia Bank.
It did not receive. It received it from Mr. Cates.
Okay, from Mr. Cates. Now, would you go so far as to say that if Mr. Cates had made a fraudulent representation with respect to the value of the securities that he was pledging to Bankers Trust, and Bankers Trust alleged that it relied on that representation, that Bankers Trust would not have a 10b-5 action against him?
Our position is that Bankers Trust Company doesn't need to proceed against him in 10b-5. At the time he pledged the collateral...
Could it?
No, our position, Your Honor, is that it does not need that. He would have executed a note at that time, as well as the pledge of collateral, and we could proceed against him on the note.
Well,
we could also,
But could you proceed against him? You certainly couldn't proceed against him on the. Could you proceed against him on the note under 10b-5?
No, we don't. We wouldn't need that. We could proceed against him in state court.
Could you proceed against him by virtue of the fraudulent representation in connection with the pledge, by virtue of 10b-5?
Our position is. No. We do not need that as a remedy.
I wasn't asking whether you needed it. I was asking whether it would be available if your management changed and the new management thought you did need it.
Isn't your position simply that there would be no sale?
Exactly.
That is correct.
Well,
there is no sale,
the answer is
there
no.
Is a pledge.
That's all I was trying to find out.
Thank you. The loan was in the process of being... Do you have any other questions, Justice Rehnquist?
Not right now.
Okay. The loan was in the process of being repaid. In 1971, a dispute arose between Cates, the pledger, and Equity National, the issuer of the stock. Bankers was informed of the dispute by Equity National, who asked that the stock be returned to them. They then contacted Cates, and Cates' attorneys advised Bankers not to return the collateral, but he was entitled to return the collateral upon repayment of the indebtedness. Bankers then informed Equity National that it was obligated to return the collateral to its borrower, Cates, upon repayment of the indebtedness. And it might consider talking to Equity National if it were indemnified. Equity National did nothing. A year later, negotiations began between Cates, Arnold, and Fowler with respect to the Equity National stock, as well as a block of 100,000 shares of Merck stock. And at that time, Cates wanted to have these transactions handled together. Bankers did not introduce Cates to Arnold and Fowler and had no relationship there. On February 24, 1972, a contract of sale was entered into between Cates, Arnold, and Fowler with respect to the Equity National stock and with respect to the Merck stock.
There was a Mr. Kupferman in here somewhere, too.
Oh, no, he comes in later in the picture. Uh-huh. He's much later in the picture, right. Your Honor.
Mr. Weiner, that particular sale you would concede is a sale within the meaning of the statute.
The sale between
Cates to Arnold and Fowler.
Cates to Arnold and Fowler is a sale.
And your position is the pledges were not in connection with that sale.
That is correct, sir.
Or the release of the pledge was not in connection.
That is correct, sir. The closing in that contract, the closing was scheduled for February 29th. On February 29th, apparently, Arnold and Fowler didn't have the $156,000, but Fowler gave Cates an additional $10,000 to get an extension of time. He received a 4 or 5 day odd extension of time for this thing, and again, this was unknown to bankers. Unbeknownst to bankers, Malice had some dealings with Mr. Arnold on or about March 1st. Arnold told Malice of the deal, and he said someone could make some money if they would loan him the funds for which he would be able to consummate the transaction, which he was going to make $400,000 out of, $480,000. Arnold suggested that he participate, and then in his affidavits, Mr. Malice states that the suggestion was also by Mr. Murphy of Franklin National Bank. Mr. Murphy of the Franklin National Bank told Malice that Cates enjoyed a good reputation in the business world, and that the securities appeared worthwhile and free of any restrictions. Okay. And then there was an agreement by Malice and Kupferman to borrow monies from Franklin and loan the money to Arnold and Fowler. Bankers, again, was totally unaware of this. Bankers was not privy to any of these transactions with Malice and Kupferman. On the morning of March 3rd, Malice and Kupferman went into the offices of Franklin National Bank in the suburbs. They signed the necessary documents, and then Malice was told by Murphy, no need to be present. The transaction, he expected the transaction to be paid by a sale of 100,000 shares of Merck & Co. stock. Now, the pledge transaction was a usurious contract because Dr. Malice, at the time he loaned these gentlemen $156,000, was going to make a, quote, profit of $50,000 within 30 days. Arithmetically computed, that comes to 383%. And this was raised by Mr. Fowler in the state court action. The critical fact here is that no one alleges that Bankers Trust, nor any of its representatives, including its attorneys, did anything, either by action or non-action, until the closing on the afternoon of March 3rd. Bankers did not introduce Cates to Arnold and Fowler. Bankers did not even know of the existence of Malice and Kupferman until after the closing and the beginning of these lawsuits.
Mr. Weiner, would it make any difference if the bank had introduced the parties or known all these details? Would that be have any relevance to the legal issue?
It doesn't have any real relevance
then
to the issue.
Then why do we dwell on those facts?
But they go to the in connection.
They go to whether or not he committed a fraud, isn't that it?
Yes, in connection with arguments.
Don't we, for purposes of our decision, have to assume that Banker's Life committed some kind of a fraud, but it's not in connection with the sale of his
security? That is correct, sir. Right. Banker's only function at the collateral was to return collateral to its debtor, Cates, upon repayment of the indebtedness, as it was required to do under the New York Uniform Commercial Code. At the closing, Arnold asked Cates for an affidavit on behalf of the respondents, Malice and Kupferman. On the basis of information furnished by Fowler, he knew that there was a problem between Equity National, Cates, and Arnold. Fowler had contacted the president of Equity National, and he told Arnold of this. That's in the depositions in the state court, which we just obtained. And Arnold accepted an affidavit from Cates saying that there were no restrictions. At that time, Bankers had no knowledge with respect to these transactions. The stock was redeemed by Mr. Cates and was returned to the Cateses. Indeed, at the closing, a check was offered to Bankers Trust Company, made payable to Bankers Trust Company and Cates. Bankers Trust Company refused to touch that check because Bankers Trust said, "I am not privy to any of these transactions." Originally, a state court of action was instituted against Bankers. That action was dismissed. The court there said that how could Bankers be liable where they didn't know these people or had nothing to do with these people? But at the same time that action was dismissed, a suit against Fowler and Arnold was still part of that action, alleging a breach of contract as well as fraud. Fowler and Arnold instituted third-party actions on the breach of contract against Bankers. These actions are still pending in the state court. Indeed, the deposition of Malice by Bankers is now scheduled for February 1, 1978. This is plainly an analogous situation to the Blue Chip case and Birnbaum, whereby there is a remedy in state court. The cases are still pending in the state court, and there is no need for 10B or 10B5 in this situation. It is our position that a pledge of stock is not a sale within the meaning of the Act. The plain language of the Act in Blue Chip Stamps and Hockfelder, as pointed out by this court there, stated that since we are dealing with a judicially created right, the court must construe the statute narrowly. And the statute requires that there be a purchase or sale. A pledger of stock is not a seller of stock. All right, title, and interest remain in the pledger. The pledger has the right to the dividends. He has all voting rights. He has any increase in value of the stock remains in the pledger. And he has the right to dispose of the securities when and to whomever he wishes. A pledge is merely a security interest. And the pledgee, as is Bankers, must act in accordance with law. And the Uniform Commercial Code very carefully defines the duties and obligations of a pledge. In that situation.
Mr. Weiner, when you talk about the Act, I take it you're talking about the Securities Exchange Act of 1934.
That's correct, sir.
Yet I look at the complaint, and it seems to have been brought under the Securities Act of 1933.
The action was originally instituted under the Securities Act of 1933. In fact, they even assert in that the only obligation of Bankers was to return the collateral to Mr. Cates.
Right.
Subsequent thereto, there were various attempts to amend the complaint, and they attempted to amend the complaint by making numerous affidavits to Judge Pollack. Judge Pollack treated these affidavits as if they were a part of an amended complaint and treated this as if it were an action under the 1934 Act and Rule 10b-5. That's how it proceeded from Judge Pollack through the Court of Appeals.
And it's clear now, is it, all around, that this is an complaint under the 34 Act and
that is correct. We are litigating it
Rule 10b-5.
As a Rule 10b-5 and Rule 10b-5 violation.
Promulgated under that statute.
Yes.
complaint doesn't indicate that. Right?
I know it doesn't.
Mr. Weiner, do you contend there's a difference in the meaning of the word sale between the 33 Act and the 34
yes,
Act?
Yes, there is. It's a very plain difference, sir. Mm-hmm. The sale in the 33 Act is much broader than it is in the 34
well,
Act.
It uses the word pledge, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't. They say otherwise dispose of an interest in security for value, of an interest for value. While we would prefer that that act also be construed as not including a pledge.
Pretty hard to do so, wouldn't it be?
Pardon?
Pretty hard not to say a pledge is a disposition of an interest in a security, is it?
Well, the SEC, Alan Troop, the Fairly General Counsels, and, which is cited in our brief, refer to the that definition, and they sort of indicate that a pledge was not a sale for purposes of a 1933 Act.
In any event, we're dealing here with the 34
we
Act.
We are dealing with the 34
Rule 10b-5
Act,
promulgated right. thereunder.
And there is no statutory definition of sale, is that right?
There is not in the Act, sir. It's just sale or purchase.
Yeah.
The important fact, well, additional, I'm saving time for the clearinghouse. As this Court has stated in its recent decisions in Santa Fe, Piper, Blue Chip Stamps, Congress, in enacting the 1934 Securities Act, did not intend to create a federal commercial law. Congress merely intended to regulate the sale and purchase of securities as an investment. Congress did not intend to get involved with the lending, the commercial paper situation in this area. Indeed, if we would broadly construe purchase for 10b-5 purposes, as sought by the SEC and as found by the Second Circuit, would render an unmanageable flood of litigation. Whenever a loan goes into default, the debtor pledgee frequently will utilize any source to avoid and delay repayment of an obligation because, as this Court is aware, the federal rules are very extensive with respect to discovery, and summary judgment is much more difficult to get in the federal courts than it is in the state court action. And federal courts have a sufficient burden to handle the litigation which is properly before it. They should not be and do not need to be involved in extensive litigation which is properly the subject of state court action. If, as the SEC and Malice assert, that any time a transaction touches securities, the transactions will be subject to the federal courts, the scope of 10b and 10b-5 would be extended far beyond what Congress intended. Congress plainly did not intend to include, as part of the securities laws, the release of, of collateral from a pledge. Although, as Judge Stevens asked, we do not believe that there was any misrepresentation and there was no purchase. Nonetheless, before an action can be instituted, the plaintiff must satisfy the statutory requirement in connection with between the alleged misrepresentation and the purchase or sale. There must be a nexus or causation between the defendants and the plaintiff. In this case, there was no such nexus. Bankers did not know of their existence. Bankers accepted the pledge of collateral in August 1970. Its customer redeemed the collateral on March 3, 1972. The contract had been entered into to purchase the collateral on February 26th, and everything had been locked in long before there was any participation of bankers at the closing. There is no possible way of imposing upon bankers a duty to make any disclosure when it did not even know these people's existence. The bankers was only a passive participant in a transaction organized by Arnold and Malice. The Court of Appeals sought to place a connecting link by finding that bankers was a seller by the release of the collateral and Malice and Kupferman purchasers by virtue of the acceptance of the pledge. But this finding skips two intervening transactions. Bankers released the collateral to Cates. Cates had sold the stock to Arnold and Fowler, and Arnold and Fowler may have pledged the stock to Malice and Kupferman. There was no real connection in this situation. A bank's release of its collateral to its debtor is plainly no representation of the value of the collateral to any third party, nor of its bona fides to any unknown third party. As Judge Cardozo stated in Ultramaris and recognized by this Court in Blue Chip Stamps and Hockfelder, to hold Bankers Trust liable in this case would be to extend liability in an indeterminate amount for an indeterminate time to an indeterminate class. Congress did not so intend to expand the securities laws.
Do I correctly read the Second Circuit opinion as relying on cases that arose chiefly under the 33 Act rather than the 34?
That is correct, sir.
Where there's a much broader definition of sale.
That is correct, sir. But the Gentile and Guild Films were both 33 Act cases, and they were both enforcement actions. In fact, this Court in National Securities stated that there's a distinction between a 10b-5 action and an enforcement action. And that's what the Second Circuit did. Thank you.
Mr. Warden.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. The principal proposition that is decisive of this case is the fact that the words purchase and sale used in the 1934 Act are ordinary words, and under the teachings of this Court must therefore be accorded their commonly accepted meanings. Those commonly accepted meanings do not include pledge transactions, that is, the pledging of securities or other property, or the release of a pledge. Purchase and sale involve the transfer of ownership for consideration. A pledge does not transfer ownership or a general property interest in the pledged property. I might say at this point, in response to Mr. Justice Stewart's question earlier about statutory definition that does include pledge, that's in the Public Utility Holding Company Act of 1935. And its inclusion there, we submit, shows that when Congress wants to impose upon a common word such as purchase or sale an artificial or special meaning to avoid repetition of a lengthy number of terms in order to achieve the purposes of a statute, it knows perfectly well how to do so. There is no indication in the legislative history or otherwise that either the 1933 Act or the 1934 Act was intended to regulate credit transactions in the ordinary course of business on a face-to-face basis. As Professor Loss has pointed out in criticizing even the Guild Films decision under the 33 Act, federal law was not required to deal with individual loan transactions. What Congress was concerned about was the regulation of primary and secondary public securities markets of this country. Now, the statutes as drafted, of course, cover personally negotiated purchases and sales, a point made by the SEC in its brief. And that's quite true. The statute as drafted, both of them do cover that. That indicates that Congress did not attempt to draw a line between public trading in securities and private purchases and sales of securities. But it did deal with purchases and sales, not with regulation of credit transactions. The Court of Appeals and the SEC in its brief have suggested that the ordinary meaning of purchase and sale should be disregarded because of the statutory definition, which says sale includes a contract to sell or otherwise dispose of. There is nothing in the legislative history that indicates that the addition of the words and otherwise dispose of, or otherwise dispose of, was intended to take away the very core of the meaning of the word sell. In fact, as we point out in our brief, a strict definition of the word sell, as obtaining at that time, involved the transfer of ownership for a price paid in money. And the words and otherwise dispose of extend the definition of the word sale to an exchange or barter transaction, or as this case held in SEC against National Securities, a statutory merger where there is, in fact, an exchange of ownership, but not for consideration in money. To attempt to read anything more into those words without any warrant in the legislative history is to engage in construction by speculation.
Do you think there has to be a transfer of title, so to speak, transfer of ownership?
Mr. Justice Stewart, I think that it would probably be sufficient if there were a purchase and sale in the ordinary informal sense. That is, if I said to someone, I will sell you a part interest in the 100 shares of General Motors that I own, and he said, fine, I'll pay you $1,000 for that, and I took it, I think that would be a purchase or sale within the meaning of the statute. I don't think that transfer on the books of the transfer agent or turning the shares in to get 250 share certificates would be required.
Mr. Ward, what about the phrase in connection with?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that anything that was done or alleged to have been done by Bankers Trust in this case is in connection with the transaction of which the plaintiffs complain. That transaction, as Mr. Weiner pointed out, was entirely arranged before this closing occurred in the offices of Bankers Trust. And I might point out that that aspect of the case is one of the aspects of the case that has raised serious concern in the banking community, because it's quite a common thing for banks, which after all maintain conference rooms for the purposes of closings, to afford the use of those rooms to their customers for the conduct of transactions. And if that brings one's activities into disputes that otherwise don't involve the bank, what you have is an inhibition on a bank's making facilities available to people,
Mr.
which
Warren,
doesn't serve the public interest in any way.
Is that quite correct? I understood the Mr. Weiner to agree that we must assume that the bank is charged with a fraud here, and we have to accept that for the purpose of the case. That's something more than making a conference room available, isn't it?
Well, it's not quite sure what clear from reading this record. I happen to agree with Mr. Justice Stewart that the facts of this case are rather hard
to understand.
But if
there's no fraud, we
don't
need to talk about it.
It's not quite clear what it is that supposedly constituted that misrepresentation or how it was in connection with the transaction of which these plaintiffs complained, Mr. Justice Stevens, in that it's clear from the facts, and there are more facts here than there are in most motion to dismiss situations. There were a lot of affidavits, and there was a state court record, that the transaction was entirely arranged by the Cateses with Fowler and Arnold, and that Fowler and Arnold found these plaintiffs, and that Bankers Trust Company had never heard of them. Then the closing occurs, and it's alleged that some unknown kind of misrepresentation was made at that closing.
But the closing was a ministerial proceeding. Is it not alleged, and do we not have to assume it for the purpose of the decision? It may not be proved, ultimately, that at the closing, Bankers Trust made a fraudulent misrepresentation. We have to assume that for purposes of the decision.
That's what the Court of Appeals
So that's
decision.
Different than just making a conference room available.
That's what the Court of Appeals. No, but I think that does indicate, Your Honor, you're quite right. That's what the Court of Appeals decision says, and this Court must assume it. But I don't think that that's entirely different than the point I was making, because talk of that kind is pretty cheap, and once they're in the conference room and these transactions occur and instruments are passed across the table, it's very easy for someone to allege that, and this allegation, by the way, 3 years after the state court complaint was dismissed, the allegation of misrepresentation made in this case is made on information. 3 years after their case had been thrown out of the state court.
But, Mr. Warren, it may be a very weak case, but it has nothing to do with the legal question we're supposed to decide.
All right, but we do, proceeding from there, we do have to decide whether the misrepresentation was in any way in connection with. Now, what is that misrepresentation, and how could it be in connection with? Either Bankers Trust would have to be considered a seller, and the Court of Appeals handled that problem by saying that the release of the pledge is a sale, and with no further explication at all, and all the release of a pledge is a performance of a duty imposed on the bank by law upon payment of the loan, or somehow there would have to be a finding that that Bankers Trust was an aider and a better, and this Court has expressly reserved in blue chip stamps the question of whether there's any civil liability for aiding and abetting under 10b-5. Now, one or the other of those bridges would have to be crossed in order to make this misrepresentation that this Court must assume existed. I quite agree.
But aren't all those matters that would be resolved at a later stage in the proceeding as Justice Stevens suggested?
Your Honor, I think that they're both questions of law. Whether a release of a pledge is a sale under 10B is a question of law. I submit the answer to that is no, it is not. And whether there is civil liability for aiding and abetting under 10B-5 is a question of law. Then if that question is answered in the affirmative, the plaintiff would be free to attempt to prove the aiding and abetting.
In other words, what you're saying, I take it, is that if the Court of Appeals had read the 1934 Act definitions, they would have arrived at this result as a matter of law.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And they wouldn't have to, no one would have to delve into the facts.
That's correct, Mr. Chief Justice. It's our position that these statutes on their face and in the history were not passed to regulate credit transactions, and that a loan, whether or not secured by stock or other property, remains a loan and is not, as the SEC contends, an investment in securities. Thank you.
Mr. Hauser.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, as counsel to the respondents, I have agreed to share my argument time with the general counsel to the SEC, and he will generally argue that a pledge of stock is the equivalent of a sale for the purposes of the Securities and Exchange Act of 1934, and that therefore the respondents have standing as pledgees to sue. Now, the appellants, it seems to me, have spent most of their argument time in arguing against the position taken by the SEC in their brief amicus curiae to this Court. I, on the other hand, represent some people who are out $156,000 as a result of what I consider to be egregious fraud. In view of the fact that some of the members of the Court apparently have had some problem in obtaining the facts from this record, which comes about because Judge Pollack dismissed the complaint before any discovery and even in advance of a motion to dismiss.
He denied leave to amend, didn't he?
He denied leave to amend. He refused no opportunity to discover any facts which would allow the opportunity to discover the jurisdictional basis. I would.
Well, you can't file a motion for discovery until you have received permission to file your amended complaint.
That's correct.
And he denied leave to
amend. He denied that leave.
So you can't complain about the lack of discovery.
Well, I can complain about it in this respect. In Woodward against the Bank of Dallas, which is cited by the briefs by the parties to this Court, the district court in a similar situation, a pledge situation, held and held twice before the trial that dismissal in a pledge situation of a 10b-5 case would be premature because the plaintiff might be able to prove enough facts to spell out the requisite standing to sue as required by Rule 10b-5. And eventually, when the case did reach the Fifth Circuit, I think it was, the Court dismissed the complaint, but not on the basis that there wasn't any jurisdiction. They expressly found there was jurisdiction where stock had been pledged to a bank, dismissed it on the ground that the bank's knowledge of what had occurred with respect to a fraud was insufficient to impose liability upon them. Now, we were denied that opportunity. Now, let me tell you something about
this gigantic fraud and all you're talking about. How much that is involved in the litigation now pending in the New York State courts?
Well, the amount that the plaintiffs are out at this time is $156,000 plus 5 years' interest. As regards their action in the state court, it's been dismissed as against Bankers Trust Company. They have no claim against Bankers Trust Company now. The only thing they have is a claim against the so-called buyers of record, Arnold and Fowler, for deceit, breach of contract, malpractice, whatever else they could think of. Those parties, in their turn, have asserted a third-party claim against Bankers Trust Company. But the plaintiffs do not have Bankers Trust Company as a direct defendant in that action. Now, the There were restrictions on the transferability of the stocks in question, and they were spelled out on the certificates themselves. They were made a part of the record of pages 34 and 38. Bankers was advised by a hand-delivered letter from the issuer of the securities, Equity National Industries, in March of 1971 that these stocks were worthless. At that time, they held stock, they held the stock as collateral, having received it from Jerome Cates. They received a second letter from the issuer in April of 1971. They knew they were in trouble with this stock and Cates because they went so far as to reduce their claim to judgment on July 20th, 1971.
When you say they knew they were in trouble, you mean they knew that the pledge they had taken as security was very likely worthless?
Absolutely. I don't think it's a common experience on the part of banks which have made loans to reduce their claims to judgment where they hold collateral. But in this case, they did so. On July 20th, 1971, judgment was entered in favor of Bankers and against Jerome Cates and Judith Cates, who had pledged the stock to the bank. Now, in February of 1972, the issue commenced an action in the district court, and on March 3, 1972, a closing took place. Now, Bankers says, and there's no support for it in the record, that they were served with the summons and complaint and the action which had been filed a month before in the district court on March 10, 1973, 1 week to the day after the closing. In the state court action, they made the representation to the court that they believed on the closing that the stock was valuable. They certainly made that same representation in the closing room when my clients, through a representative of the Franklin National Bank, expended the sum of $156,000.
Now, is that in the record?
Yes.
I mean, the fact that they made the representation, or is it just alleged?
No. The plaintiffs have an affidavit as part of the record. It appears as part of the record that an affirmative representation was made by a representative of the Bankers Trust Company, and I understand that this court is not bound by facts which are not in the record, but for whatever it's worth, I can make the affirmative representation that I have an affidavit in my own file to that effect.
Well, is there an affidavit in the record?
The affidavit was not obtained until after the record was filed in this court.
Well, you mean their affidavit wasn't before Judge Pollack?
The plaintiff's affidavit was before Judge Pollack.
The plaintiff's affidavit
was
before Judge.
Yes, it was.
Which now included.
It is included in the record to this court.
Does that include an allegation, a representation about the Bankers Trust representation?
You mean in the complaint which we were not allowed to amend? The answer is no.
No, but the affidavit, that was before Judge Pollack?
Yes, the affidavit alleges that the affirmative representation.
Where is that?
Page 110.
Now, this was before Judge Pollack?
Yes, sir. Yes, page 110.
What does it say? And what are you referring to?
I'll quote the language exactly. We are informed by our attorneys and believe that we have a good and meritorious cause of action against the defendants, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, European American Bank, as well as Franklin National Bank. I'll skip down to B. Against Bankers Trust Company, which withheld vitally material information from us and our representatives, and as we are informed, actually misrepresented that the securities in question were genuine when, in fact, they were not.
Informed by whom?
By the representative.
It wouldn't help me at all because I don't know a thing from it. He says we start off with that we are informed.
Bankers Trust Company
That's
withheld
real.
Vitally material information from us and our representatives.
I understood you to say that there was an affidavit which said positively that Bankers Trust said that this was good.
Yes, sir.
Well, where is that here?
Right here.
That's on information.
Yes, it is.
Well, that's no good.
Well, we were denied the opportunity, as I mentioned before, to amend our complaint so as to affirmatively allege it.
Yeah.
We have not had that opportunity. Now, there are three reasons why this court should affirm the district court's, the Second Circuit's decision. In the first place, it's not at all clear whatever the plaintiffs may have understood this transaction to have meant to them. They say that they were lenders. They understood that they were lenders. But the only document in the record which indicates what their relationship was with Arnold and Fowler appears at page 49 of the record, and I would call Your Honor's attention to the language of the letter. Your participation in the purchase, says Mr. Arnold to Mr. Malis. Your advance of $156,000 toward the purchase price. Your participation in the trade. Your investment. And finally, you will be reimbursed. Now a loan presupposes that it'll be repaid. But nowhere in that letter does it say by whom. Now, I don't think that any member of this court would grant summary judgment against Arnold or Fowler on the theory that he received a loan from Malis or Cates. It seems to me that if they didn't borrow the money, that neither Malis nor Cates was a lender, and I think it's too early to conclude what their position was. Certainly you can't conclusively assume that they were lenders rather than participants in the trade. Now, let us assume for a moment that they were lenders. If as this court has said, the starting point for the determination of standing to sue under Rule 10b-5 is the statute, then the statute says that a fraud made, and I quote, in connection with, close quote, a sale, is the trigger for 10b-5 liability. Now, of course, there was a sale here. The sale, the reason that the case is perhaps a little confusing is because it's sandwiched in between the release of one pledge and the creation of another pledge. But the pledge to Malis and Kupferman was simultaneous with the purchase by Arnold and Fowler, if indeed they were the purchasers. I draw your attention to the fact that Arnold, when he signed the purchase agreement, signed it as attorney, that is, in a representative capacity. Now, there could have been no sale except for the fact that Malis and Kupferman came with the money, through their representative, of course, to a closing. At the closing, their money was expended, and the sale took place.
But Mr. Hauser, this sale you're describing now is a sale from Cates.
Yes, sir.
Arnold and Paul.
Yes,
well,
exactly
not
right.
Not from Bankers Trust.
No,
that's right.
Not from Bankers Trust. I don't claim the Bankers Trust was a seller, and I don't think that the...
You don't claim that the release of the pledge was a sale, then?
I don't believe that the mere release of a pledge is a sale.
So you do not say Bankers Trust was a seller?
I don't believe that Bankers Trust was a seller. I don't believe that within the meaning of the Act, I don't believe that they were the seller. Now, the next question is, were the plaintiffs connected? Well, they advanced at the closing 86% of the purchase price of this stock, and they received at the closing all of the things sold. They were more connected than Arnold was, because Arnold put up less than 24% of the purchase price. There could have been no sale without the use of their funds at the closing. They were directly and intimately connected with the sale. To say that they were not imposed upon in connection with, in the words of the statute, a sale is to make a mockery of what the statute calls for.
Well, doesn't the Second Circuit opinion seem to be in some disagreement with you on whether the release of the pledge is a sale or
yes.
The Bankers Trust?
I don't think that to the extent that the Second Circuit said that the release of by bankers of the pledge was a sale of stock, I don't think that it was necessary to their decision. I think that all that was required was
Do you think they thought it was?
Do I think that they thought it was a sale?
Well, I know, but do you think they thought that holding was essential in their decision?
I don't think so. I think that they could have that the decision would have been the same way, strictly on the basis of a finding that plaintiffs were buyers within the meaning of the statute.
And that this release was in connection with the sale.
Yes.
Your position then is that a fraudulent representation by someone who himself is not a seller is actionable under 10b-5.
Absolutely.
And but you do. It is necessary that for you to claim and for us to agree with you that a pledge is a sale.
No. I don't think so.
You don't,
I think
you,
that
you,
all be, I think...
Because you say there was a sale that took place here and this release was in connection with the sale.
Right. I say that if the sale occurs at the identical time as does the pledge...
Yes.
That the pledge is in connection with the sale. You can't have a sale without
a pledge.
How do you view the
question whether a pledge is a sale?
How do I view whether a pledge is a sale?
Is a pledge a sale or not?
I don't think that it's necessary for...
So you disagree with the Court of Appeals again?
I don't disagree with the Court of Appeals on that. I don't think that it's necessary to reach that conclusion as to whether every pledge, ipso facto, constitutes a sale within the meaning of the Securities Exchange Act.
Well, you wouldn't suggest the Court of Appeals didn't think it was necessary for its decision to hold that a pledge was a sale.
I do think that the Court of Appeals so thought.
But you don't defend that conclusion.
I don't necessarily defend that conclusion. I do know that somehow, somewhere, I don't know exactly when, where fraudulent securities are pledged to a pledgee, I know that somewhere there comes a time that the pledgee has standing to sue for a violation of Rule 10b-5. Mr. Justice Rehnquist asked a question during the course of Mr. Weiner's argument. What would happen if a note was given and stock given back in exchange? Mr. Weiner... Oh, my time is up.
Well, I'd be interested to hear what you...
And Mr. Weiner responded that there wouldn't be any answer, that there is no... That there would be no occasion to go to a 10b-5 remedy. But suppose, for example, that the note itself was a forgery, and the fellow had sent along his collateral and now denied liability, although conceding that he had signed the stock for whatever purpose. Now, the bank would be foreclosed from suing on the debt, but they would not be foreclosed from suing under 10b-5, and it's not a far-fetched possibility.
Your position, I take it, is that you can rely on the sale from Arnold to Malice.
Right.
And the misrepresentation made by Bankers Trust was in connection with that.
Positively, specifically.
And that would protect the new pledgee or not? Could the new pledgee recover too?
Yes. The plaintiffs are the new pledgees.
Yes, I know.
If they aren't the buyers.
You said that you don't need to hold that they are buyers at all.
I said
Let's
that...
Let's assume that they are not buyers, that a pledge is not a sale or a purchase.
Yes.
And so the new pledgee is neither isn't a buyer.
Okay.
And he didn't get the stock from a seller. But Bankers isn't a seller either. But it makes a misrepresentation in connection with a sale. The new pledgee can recover?
Yes. I say that the sale... as to which the pledgee generates with the use of his funds is sufficient to supply the statutory requirement of in connection with a sale.
Well, that certainly isn't the theory of the Court of Appeals, is
no,
it?
No, I don't think it is.
Mr. Pitts?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court.
Do you think, Mr. Pitt, that the Court of Appeals' opinion stands independent of these the analysis we've just been discussing?
I think that the analysis of the Court of Appeals with respect to a pledge being a sale is correct. We take no position on whether the release of a stock with respect to a natural fulfillment of the pledge agreement is a sale for purposes of the Act, and as the petitioners themselves argue, that was irrelevant.
So you think that's just the Court of Appeals didn't need to say that?
I think that the opinion stands analytically without that holding. It may well be that some of the judges on the Second Circuit were concerned about finding a completed transaction, a sale and a purchase, but I think, as our brief attempts to demonstrate, analytically, there was a sale with respect to the pledge transaction.
You think then there's very little chance that if we were to disagree with the Court of Appeals on whether a release is a sale, there's very little chance that if we remanded it to them, they would come out any other way than they did?
I would agree with that. I would also say at this juncture that our concern is not with the release of securities. after a pledge transaction, although there is a conceivable possibility that in some circumstances fraud may be induced in the holder of the collateral, and that might be actionable.
So in your view, a banker's liability rests on finding that if they made a misrepresentation, it was in connection with a sale, not that they were a seller.
That is correct. I think that we have gotten away from privity, and as I understand Mr. Justice Rehnquist's decision in the blue chip stamps case, this court specifically referred to the fact that 10b-5 has gone light years
and
away.
And what sale do you say their release was in connection with? The new pledge?
If I may, Your Honor, not the release. The sale occurred when Arnold and Fowler pledged their stock to Malice and Kupferman, and Bankers Trust affirmatively made a misrepresentation to these plaintiffs.
So it's in connection with the new pledge that you say they made a misrepresentation.
That is correct, and that is all this court need focus on, except insofar as it may be concerned about the motivation of Bankers Trust, as is alleged in the pleadings in the courts below.
So we're not talking here at all about the pledge by Cates to Bankers Trust, nor the release by Bankers Trust of the collateral.
Definitely not. We are talking solely about the pledge from Arnold and Fowler to Malice that was induced by Bankers Trust affirmative misrepresentation as alleged in the papers in this court proceeding.
Again, that's quite a deviation from the Second Circuit's reasoning, isn't it?
Pardon?
Isn't this quite a deviation from the reasoning?
Your Honor, I believe that is precisely what the Second Circuit was holding with respect to that side of the transaction.
That is the pledge.
That is the pledge. The Second Circuit also felt
that
it appropriate.
The release to Cates by Bankers Trust of the collateral was a sale.
Yes.
It said that.
But analytically, once Bankers Trust was satisfied as to the legal terms of its contract with Cates, it is arguable that that release should not be deemed a sale. That is not of concern in this case, and that is not an issue we think that is before this court.
And then we have now a third theory of to support 10b-5 liability, i.e. that Bankers Trust made a misrepresentation in connection with a sale from A to B, Bankers Trust being X. That's the theory just advanced by your brother, as I understood it.
If I have given the impression that there is yet a third theory, then I must apologize.
Well, it's not you. It's your brother, as I say.
I believe that the theory that we have espoused is wholly consistent with the Second Circuit's decision.
We don't have before us the question of whether a release is a sale, a release of a pledge is a sale. The Second Circuit said it was. And if that were sustainable, you might get one result in this case, and if it wasn't, you might get another.
Analytically, I would submit that is irrelevant to the decision, and
You've already submitted it, but
I'd like to explain why, if I may. The fraud occurred in connection with a misrepresentation made to Malice to pay over funds sufficient to accomplish the purchase, and upon which he was induced to rely on the investment value of the securities that served as collateral for the loan transaction. If there was fraud, as is this court must assume based on the procedural posture of this case, then Arnold and Fowler, in pledging the stock, Malice and Kupferman, in taking the stock, were defrauded based on the investment value of that stock. It matters not that prior to that transaction, Bankers Trust released the stock to Cates so that Cates could give it to Arnold and Fowler. That is really irrelevant to the fraud in this case.
Mr. Pitt, Bankers Trust, paragraph on page 110, do you have anything more than that to show its implication? Or are you also relying on this one paragraph about the informants?
Your Honor, we are relying on 110, as I understand it.
And what else?
On 110 as to the affirmative misrepresentations, right. Yes.
And what else?
We are relying solely on the fact that as a motion to dismiss, that this can be pleaded on information and belief.
And what all I'm trying to get is this is all you have.
This is all, Your Honor.
Denial of a motion to amend, not a motion to dismiss, wasn't it?
Your Honor, as I understand the procedures, what occurred here was that Judge Pollack instituted a motion to dismiss on his own suggestion and in connection with that refused to allow an amendment of the complaint. However, in his decision dismissing the complaint, which is what he did, he indicated that he would deem the complaint most favorably alleged under Section 10B and Rule 10b-5. So he effectively extrapolated all of the materials that are before this Court and deemed it to be an amendment and still dismissed it. But he denied formal leave to amend the complaint.
According to the Court of Appeals, there was no judgment in the district court.
Except a motion to dismiss.
Well, except a motion is not a judgment.
I'm sorry, except the dismissal of the action.
They say every good case requires a mystery document, and in this case, the missing document is the judgment.
That may be, Your Honor.
I take it from what you've said that it wouldn't have made any difference to your position whether there'd ever been a pledge to bankers and released by bankers. Is that correct?
That's right.
No, although I think when this case is tried, one of the allegations that the plaintiffs appear to be making is that bankers, realizing it had a defective set of securities as collateral, was anxious and deliberately misrepresented the value of that stock so that it could get out of its bad transaction. In that sense, I think it might be relevant. But, of course, that is speculation at this juncture.
Well, that goes to the merits of the case.
And that is precisely what we've been hearing to some extent, I must say, respectfully, from my brothers.
Right.
The issue in this case.
The question here is whether or not there was a purchase or sale as within the meaning of the Act, the 34 Act.
That is correct.
10b-5, and as my brother Powell suggests, that question is wholly interdependent of whether there had ever been a pledge by Cates to Bankers Trust.
That is precisely our position.
Bankers Trust could have held the securities in safekeeping, not having ever received them under a pledge.
That, analytically, that would not affect the allegation of fraud in this case. I quite agree. Indeed, if I may assert what we think the issue is, we would assert that when a person is deceived into parting with money in exchange for an interest in securities, that is precisely the type of situation to which the federal securities laws' anti-fraud protections were intended to apply.
But there has to be a sale.
There must be a disposition of an interest which is a sale.
Right.
That is correct.
And the pledge by Arnold to Malice and Kupperman was a sale under your theory.
That's it.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was.
May I ask this, since I have interrupted you? How long has the SEC taken the position you take here today? Pledge as a sale.
We have taken that position since the late 1950s.
Have you issued any releases to that effect?
We have filed a number of lawsuits. We have a number of cases which are set forth in our amicus brief before this court. We have articulated that in certain cases we have exempted pledge transactions where they would otherwise be included within the definition of a sale. Indeed, the petitioners take comfort, surprisingly to us, from our Rule 16A6, in which we specifically felt the need to exempt a pledge from the operative term sale for the purposes of that rule so as not to encompass those pledges in that special limited circumstance. But otherwise, we have taken this position consistently since the 1950s.
Is there anything in the legislative history of either the Act of 33 or 34 that supports your position? That a pledge is a sale?
If there is something specific on pledges, I must confess I am unaware of that. However,
the hearings that led up to those acts were very extensive, and they dealt with all sorts of problems relating to securities. It would be curious, I would have thought, not to have gotten into the business of lending money and putting up collateral if Congress had intended to deal with it.
Your Honor, I had occasion before coming here today to review our amicus brief in the Superintendent of Insurance case, where this court expressly held that not only shareholders but creditors were specifically within the intendment of the Securities Exchange Act protections for anti-fraud. And in our brief, we did cite legislative history, which was rather diffuse. I cannot tell you that there were express references to pledge transactions, but it talked about the value of the securities held by banks, the value of securities held by insurance companies, the massive loans that were utilized. And I would point out to the court that Section 2 of the Securities Exchange Act talks about making and preserving the investment decision of investors reasonably complete and effective from anti-fraud provisions, so that I don't think there is any question that the Securities Exchange Act covers any situation in which there is an investment intent and an investment interest. I think it would be anomalous to suggest that when someone puts up $156,000, largely in reliance on the underlying value of securities and then takes possession of those securities, that that does not constitute an investment decision that this court in National Securities talked about in terms of the definition of sale and in Blue Chip talked about in terms of the limited coverage of some of the exemptions this court has applied more recently.
Mr. Pitt, in that connection, this transaction is quite extraordinary. It's very rare that private individuals lend this sort of money. The Securities Acts were concerned primarily, I had thought, with protecting unsophisticated investors. And here we're dealing primarily with banks and lending institutions. By definition, sophisticated investors, the Acts certainly weren't designed primarily to protect them. I suppose you would agree with that.
If I may, I have two responses to that. First, of course, I guess this case is ample evidence of the fact that not only sophisticated investors find themselves in this position, but more importantly, I think this question and your prior question focus on what the legitimate concern of the Securities and Exchange Commission is. And that concern deals with the fact that when securities are pledged, the next step is that those pledged securities can be foreclosed upon, they become distributed in the marketplace. The enforcement actions we refer to have shown that organized crime and many individuals are using pledge transactions as a means to circumvent our rules. In addition,
if foreclosed and if the securities have not been registered, they are subject to the provisions of the Act of 33.
Some of the cases we have had knowing schemes in that direction. Banks may be participants and not just victims. In addition, I think it's fair to point out that although the banks this court has been faced with today assert that they would not like the protections of this Act, there are many cases in which banks themselves have sought the protections of Section 10B and Rule 10B-5 in these kinds of situations. There are smaller banks and there are larger banks, but many of them, including the Exchange National Bank, in a billion-dollar transaction, in an opinion written by Judge Friendly recently, where the protections of Section 10B and Rule 10B-5 were eagerly sought out by banking institutions.
This bank isn't complaining about the protections of the Act.
Well, I understood.
Banks in this situation are going to be defendants, not plaintiffs.
In this particular situation, I agree with Mr. Justice Powell that this is a very unusual situation where the bank is alleged to have made an affirmative misrepresentation. I grant you the record is weak, and I grant you the fact that on trial, this case may not prove out at all. That is not our concern at this juncture.
I was told in pleading that when you plead something like fraud, you be specific as you can.
I was taught the same thing, Your Honor, and I wish this complaint had been more specific, but I would hope that...
Well, the difference is I stick to my teaching and you've left your...
I hope not, Your Honor. I would suggest that if we are to make a statutory determination that can have far-reaching ramifications not only for private litigants, but for the government, the Commission in civil enforcement actions, and the Justice Department in criminal actions, that hopefully some poor pleading, if that in fact is the case here, will not upset an important statutory protection that we think needs...
Mr. Pitt, did I understand you to say to Mr. Justice Powell that there wasn't any case authority for your position?
If I said that, I apologize. I thought I was asked whether there were specific references to pledge transactions in the legislative history.
Oh.
As to a specific reference to pledge transactions, I am not aware of any. As to loan and credit agreements and the importance of providing the protections of the securities laws in this context, I think there is ample legislative history. Some of it is cited in our Superintendent of Insurance amicus brief before this Court. I think this Court's decision in Superintendent of Insurance amply supports that conclusion, particularly footnote 8 on page 12 of the reported decision.
How long has the Court held that a pledge is a sale?
Consistently, with one minor exception, since we commenced raising this issue, which was started in late 1950s, the 2nd, 5th, 7th, and 10th circuits have all acknowledged that pledges are sales. In one case,
under the 33 and 34 Act.
Under both acts. In one case, I believe the Fifth Circuit had an erroneous interpretation of a limitation as to when a pledge could be a sale. But it is my understanding that these circuits have held that at least as to the 33 Act, And I'm not sure, but I think as to, in one case, as to the 34 Act, the Dalnick case that we cite, in which we alleged a 10b-5 violation, that under the 34 Act as well. If I may, in that respect, this Court has said in Mr. Justice Marshall's opinion in National Securities, as well as in the Hockfelder decision, that the interpretation of the 33 and 34 Act should be construed in para materia because they were both complementing ends toward a comprehensive scheme of regulation of the nation's securities trading activities.
Thank you.
I thought I had a few minutes.
Yes. Okay. You have about 4 minutes left.
Yes. Your Honor, Mr. Pitt referred to the phrase interest in definition of sale. Well, that is not in the 1934 Act. That is in the 1933 Act. And the 1934 Act very clearly speaks about sale or other disposition thereof. And that's one point. The second point that's important is that there's a substantial difference between buying stock to make a collateralized loan and making a collateralized loan. The lending factor, which we sought to stress earlier, is based on the general credit of the individual, and we are not they are not looking at the value of collateral. The Guild Films case, which is the first time that the SEC really pushed the question as to whether or not a pledge was a sale, was in 1960. Professor Loss refers to that case, and in that case, there was a sham transaction. It was not a pure bona fide pledge, and they expanded the question therein. Now, one of the factors that's really very, very important here is that a lot has been stated about what is beyond the record. Subsequent, and I would like to clarify some facts which have just come to our attention as a result of the state court action. We just completed the deposition of Mr. Fowler. In his examination, Mr. Fowler makes it clear, number one, he was aware of the conflict, and he and Arnold were fully aware of the conflict between Equity National Industries and the Cates.
Well, that goes to the merits of this controversy.
Yes.
We, that's no part of what's before us now.
I recognize that, sir, but there have been numerous allegations which are totally without merit.
Well,
I would like this Court to remember that.
But all we have is the pleadings.
That is true.
And all we have here is a fairly precise issue as to whether or not a pledge is a sale within the meaning of the 34 Act.
And whether or not it was in connection.
What confused me was that you in your brief were talking about the pledge by Cates to the Bankers Trust and the release of that pledge, and the SEC is talking about quite a different pledge. They're talking about the one that Arnold and Fowler made to Malice and Kupferman of the Equity National Stock.
Because the Court of Appeals speaks about our...
I know it does, and that's what makes this case factually confusing. But the single issue is a rather precise one and has nothing to do with the merits.
And whether or not it was in connection therewith also, that is a subsidiary question also, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.